Chapter 32. The basement in the shelter was unusually deep, especially for Chicago. The stairs went down about 10 feet and were only about 2.5 feet wide. My imagination treated me to a brief vision of some grinning Renfield with a machine gun popping around the corner, already shooting, bullets tearing all three of us to shreds in the space of a heartbeat. My stomach writhed in pure, nervous fear, and I forced myself to put it aside and focus on my surroundings. The walls had been mortared and painted white, but cracks and mineral stains from damp spots all but concealed the original color. At the bottom of the stairs was a landing, maybe 3 feet square, and then a second set of stairs led farther down, the air getting more cramped and colder as they went. The stale air smelled like mildew and rot. Our breathing and our movements sounded incredibly loud in the otherwise oppressive silence that followed, and I found myself pointing the paintball gun forward over Murphy's head and Kincaid's shoulder so that I could start shooting as soon as something bounded into view, for all the good it was likely to do. Against any normal thug, the weapon would do little but make them damp or vaguely aromatic. The stairway ended at a half-open old door. Kincaid nudged it slowly open with his spear, already crouched. Murphy aimed her gun at the black doorway. Me too. The end of my stupid paintball gun quivered involuntarily. Nothing happened. Silence reigned. "Damn it," I muttered. "I don't have the nerves for this crap." "Want me to find you a Valium?" Kincaid asked. "Kiss my ass," I said. He reached into his belt pouch and pulled out a couple of plastic tubes. He bent them sharply, shook them up, and they began to shine with chemical light. He edged up to the doorway and flicked one to the left, the other to the right, bouncing them off the walls so that he wouldn't expose himself to anyone in the hall beyond. Then he waited a beat and leaned out, peeking around. "Nothing moving," he reported. "No lights. But it looks like that map was pretty good. Hall on my right goes about 10 feet, then ends at the door to that closet. Open hall on my left, 20 feet long, and opens into a room." "Closet first," I said. "Cover me." Kincaid flowed down the last couple of stairs and through the door. Murphy kept within a foot of his back. Kincaid peeled off to the right. Murphy dropped into a crouch, shotgun aimed down the green-lit hall to the left. I wasn't as smooth, but I went after Kincaid, paintballs and staff ready. The closet door was only 5 feet high and opened out toward the hall. Kincaid listened at the door, then leaned aside to let me touch it first. I couldn't feel any enchantments on it and nodded to him. He shifted his grip on the spear so that he'd be ready to drive the tip of it into anything that came at him from the closet, and drew the door open. The light from his spear flickered around a dank little chamber that was too big to be a proper closet and too small to be a room. Patches of moisture and mildew blotted the damp stone walls, and the smell of unwashed bodies and waste rolled out of the door. Half a dozen children, none of them older than 9 or 10, huddled against the back wall of the closet. They were dressed in cast-off clothing, most of it far too big, and they wore steel cuffs on their hands. The cuffs, in turn, were locked to a larger chain attached to a heavy steel ring bolted into the floor. The children reacted in silent terror, flinching away from the doorway and from the light. Children. Someone was going to regret this. If I had to take this building, hell, this block apart with nothing but raw will and my bare hands, someone was going to pay. Even the monsters should draw a line somewhere. Then again, I guess that's why they call them monsters. "Son of a bitch," I snarled and ducked my head to step into the room. Kincaid abruptly threw his weight against me, shoving me aside from the door. "No," he growled. "Damn it, get out of my way," I said. "It's a trap, Dresden," Kincaid said. "There's a tripwire. Go through that door and you'll kill all of us." Murphy checked over her shoulder and returned to watching the darkness for trouble. I frowned at Kincaid and picked up the plastic light stick, holding it out. I don't see a wire. Not a literal wire, Kincaid said. It's a net of infrared beams. Infrared? How did you... Damn it, Dresden, if you want to know about me, wait for the autobiography like everyone else. He was right. It was a little late to be worrying about Kincaid's background now. Hey, kids, I said. Everybody stay really still and keep back, okay? We're going to get you out of here. I lowered my voice and said to Kincaid, how do we get them out of there? Not sure we can, Kincaid said. The beam is rigged up to an anti-personnel mine. Well, I said, can't you put a weight on a landmine and leave it there? So long as the weight holds the trigger down, it doesn't explode, right? Right, Kincaid said, but that's assuming we've gone back in time to World War II. He shook his head. Modern mines are pretty good at killing people, Dresden. This one's British, pretty recent. How can you tell? He tapped his nose. The Brits use a different chemical priming charge than most. It's probably a bouncer. Very nasty. Bouncer? Yeah. If something interrupts the beam, the charge activates. Several individual submunitions get blown up into the air, or sideways, or however they want to set it up, in a pattern. Then they explode maybe 5 or 6 feet in the air, sends a couple of thousand steel balls out in a big cloud. Kills everything in 30, maybe 40 meters if you're in the open. Maybe a lot farther in a tight space like this. If it was me, I'd have set the charges up to get thrown straight down this hall. All these stone walls, the shrapnel would shred everything real good. I could hex down whatever's sending the beam, I said. Thus interrupting it, Kincaid said. Thus kablooey, thus death. Damn it. I swallowed and took a step back from the doorway, hoping the presence of my magic wouldn't screw up the device in a moment of monumentally bad timing. I can shield us if it's all coming in from one direction. Kincaid arched an eyebrow. Yeah? Yeah. Damn. But it won't help those kids much. They're over there. I scowled ferociously. How do we disarm the device? You still don't want the Bolshevik Muppet solution, right? Right. Then someone has to crawl in there without setting it off, find the explosive, disable it, and unhook it from the sensors. Right, I said. Do it. Kincaid nodded. Can't. What? I can't. Why not? He nodded at the doorway. There are three beams set up in an asymmetrical crisscross over the doorway. There isn't enough room for me to get through the open spaces. I'm thinner than you, I said. Yeah, but longer and a hell of a lot gawkier. And I know what happens to tech when nervous wizards get close. Someone has to do it, I said. Someone small enough to... We both looked down the hall at Murphy. Murphy didn't look away from her vigil and said, how do I disarm it? I'll talk you through, Kincaid said. Dresden, better take her gun and cover us. Hey, I said, I'm in charge here. Kincaid, talk her through it. Murphy, give me your gun so I can cover you. I tied the handle of the paintball gun into my coat where my blasting rod usually went. I winked at Murphy, who saw the gesture and did not respond to it. She just passed me the gun and turned her baseball cap around. Then she walked down the hall, slipping out of her coat and gun belt on the way. Better lose the Kevlar, too, Kincaid said. I can pass it to you. Bottom left corner looks like the best bet. Stay as flat as you can and as much to the left as you can. I think you can get in. You think? I asked. What if you're wrong? He gave me an annoyed look. You don't see me telling you how to watch that goddamn doorway in case all the vampires show up at any second to kill us, do you? Kincaid asked. I was going to scowl at him, but he had a point. I scowled at the darkness instead, gripping Murphy's gun. I fumbled for a second because the riot gun must have been some kind of military issue, and it took me a second to find the safety. I flicked it to reveal the red dot. Or at least I thought it was red. The green chemical light made it look black. Stop, Kincaid said in a calm voice. Unclench. Unclench what? Murphy demanded. Unclench your ass. Excuse me? You're going to trip the beam. You need another quarter inch. Relax. I am relaxed, Murphy growled.
Oh, Kincaid said.
Damn great ass, then. Take off your pants. I winced and checked over my shoulder. Murphy was stretched out on the floor on her belly, her cheek on the cold floor, arms stretched above her. The small of her back was in the doorway. She managed to move her head just enough to eye Kincaid. Once again? Take off your pants, Kincaid said, smiling. Think of the children. She muttered something to herself and moved her arms, shifting slightly.
No good, Kincaid said. You're moving too far.
Okay, genius, Murphy said. What do I do?
Hold still, Kincaid said. I'll do it.
There was silence for a second. Murphy hissed out a breath, or maybe it was more of a gasp.
I don't bite, he said. Be still. I want to live through this.
Okay, Murphy said in a small voice a moment later. I scowled hard at the darkness and felt myself getting irrationally angry and fast. I glanced back again. Murphy wriggled forward all the way through the doorway. Her legs were pale, pretty, and strong, and I had to admit that Kincaid was completely correct about her posterior. Kincaid was bracing her legs, hands on her calves, and sliding down as she moved forward, helping her to keep them from accidentally moving too far. Or at least that damn well better have been what he was doing, because if it wasn't, I would be forced to kill him. I shook my head and returned to my vigil.
Get a grip, Harry, I thought to myself. It isn't like you and Murphy are an item. She isn't something you own. She's her own person. She does what she wants with who she wants. You're not even involved with her. You've got no say in it.
I ran through those thoughts a couple of times, found them impeccably logical, morally unassailable, and still wanted to slug Kincaid, which implied all kinds of things I didn't have time to think about. I heard them speaking quietly to each other a moment later. Murphy was describing the explosive, and Kincaid was giving her instructions. In the darkness beyond the last chemical light, I heard something move. I shifted my weight, reaching into my belt pouch for my own chemical light sticks. I pressed them against the floor to break the layer separating the two chemicals and shook them until they started to emit their own soft green fire. I threw them down the hall where they landed in the room beyond. The lights revealed little beyond more stone floor and some drywall. Bob had reported that the room was essentially a storage chamber, with several smaller chambers defined by recently installed drywall that could be used for storage, emergency shelters during the odd tornado warning, or additional rooms for those in need of a place to spend the night. But all I could see was half of a door, a couple of stacks of cardboard boxes, a dressmaker's dummy, and the glowing sticks of emerald light. And then something large and four-legged moved in front of one of the lights for a second or two. The dark hound was a large and rangy animal, maybe a large Alsatian, and it deliberately stayed in place for a moment before vanishing into the shadows once more. I kept the riot gun aimed down the hall and wished that Inari hadn't broken my damned blasting rod. I would far rather have had it than the gun. Without the blasting rod to help me focus and contain the destructive energies of flame I preferred, I didn't dare start blasting away at the bad guys with magic, especially in such tight quarters as the shelter. But then, maybe it was just as well. I had already met my quota for burning down public institutions this week. I couldn't see anything else, but I knew there was something there. So I lowered my eyelids almost all the way and focused my attention, listening. There was the faint sound of something breathing, but nothing more. It wasn't enough. I lowered the gun a bit, relaxing my shoulders, and poured more of my focus into it, listening more deeply than I ever had before. The sound of breathing became louder, and I picked out several other faint sources of it. A moment later, I began to hear a dull throbbing, which I realized was a beating heart. More heartbeats joined it, a confused chorus of drumming beats,
but I was able to identify individual rhythms into a pair of groups. One was a bit faster, lighter, smaller hearts, probably the Dark Hounds. There were four of them. The other group was human, and there were five hearts beating in an eager, savage cadence, pressed up against the walls on either side of the doorway, out of sight, but less than 20 feet away. And from the back of the room, I heard footsteps, slow and deliberate. They slid quietly across the stone floor, and the wasted outline of an emaciated female form appeared in front of one of the glow sticks, and no heartbeat accompanied it. Mavra. The Dark Hounds appeared, vague shapes, and paced restlessly through the shadows around the vampire. My heart lurched in sudden apprehension, and I released my attention from the listening. I raised the gun, got to my feet, and backed away. Again, that soft, mocking laugh drifted through the basement. "Trouble," I said over my shoulder. "Five Renfields, four Dark Hounds at least, and Mavra's awake."
"Indeed," came Mavra's dry, dusty voice. "I've been waiting for you, Dresden. There's something I've been meaning to ask you."
"Oh," I said. I looked over my shoulder at Kincaid and mouthed,
"How long?"
Kincaid had crouched and taken up his spear again. He glanced back and said,
30 seconds.
"We take the kids and run," I whispered.
"I've been admiring you for some time now, Dresden," came Mavra's voice. "I've seen you stop bullets with your power. I've seen you stop knives and claws and fangs."
She made a gesture with her hand.
"And so I simply must know how well you will fare against your own weapon of choice."
And two Renfields stepped out into the doorway, blocking my view of Mavra. Each of them held a long metal device in their hands, and each of them wore something that bulged out above their shoulders, gleaming shapes of rounded metal. A blue starter flame flickered at the end of the devices they held, and it hit me all at once what was happening. Both of the Renfields lifted their flamethrowers and filled the cramped little hallway with fire.
Chapter 33. The riot gun went off, though I'm not sure if it was because I'd instinctively decided to use the weapon, or if I just convulsed in surprise. The bad guys were 20 feet away, which was plenty of distance for the shot from the riot gun to spread. If I'd had it aimed well, it would almost certainly have put one of them down. As it was, the largest force of the blast went between them, though from the way they jerked and twisted, either the sheer roaring volume of the weapon was enough to intimidate them, or they'd caught a little shot as it went past. Fire coughed uncertainly from the mouths of the flamethrowers, spattering the hall along the floors, walls, and ceiling, where it clung in globs of what had to be a mix of gasoline or some other accelerant and petroleum jelly, homemade napalm. The air went from cold to roasting hot, even from the aborted discharge of fire, sucking the wind from my lungs. Both men, unassuming-looking types in ragged clothing, their eyes wide and fanatical, hesitated for a second before planting their feet again and taking aim once more. It was only a second, but it was enough to save my life. I dropped the gun, tossed my staff into my right hand, and shook out my shield bracelet. I rammed panicked will into the focus and spread it in a wall of energy before me. The Renfields cut loose this time, flame as thick as spray from a breached hydrant roaring down the hall. I caught it on the shield, but I had never intended it to stop heat. It was primarily a defense against kinetic energy, and while I had used it to handle everything from bullets to runaway elevator cars in my career as a wizard, it just wasn't all that good at stopping the transfer of intense heat. The napalm jelly splattered against the invisible shield, gallons of it, and the fire clung to it in white-hot glee. Its mindless fury seeped through the shield and flowed onto me. It hurt. Oh God, it hurt. The fingers of my left hand were the first to feel it, and then my palm and wrist, all in the space of a second. If you've never been burned, you can't imagine the pain. And my fingers, where millions of tactile nerves were able to send panicked damage messages to my brain, felt as if they had simply exploded and been replaced with howling agony. I jerked my hand back and felt my focus waver, the shield start to fade. I gritted my teeth, and somehow managed to dig up the strength to extend my hand again, hardening the shield and my will. I backed away in shuffling half-steps, my mind almost drowning in pain, desperately keeping the shield up.
10 seconds!
Kincaid shouted. I saw blisters rising on my left hand. I felt my fingers curling into a claw. They looked thinner, as if made of melting wax, and I could see the shadows of my bones beneath the flesh. The shield grew weaker yet. The pain got worse. I stood now at the bottom of the stairs, and as the shield faltered, the empty space between me and the doorway behind me might as well have been a mile. I didn't have 10 seconds. I reached into myself, into the horrible red pain, and drew forth more power yet. I focused it on my staff, and the sigils and runes carved along its surface became suddenly suffused with eye-searing scarlet light. My nose filled with the smell of charring wood, and as the shield wavered out of existence, I screamed,
"Vintas Servitas!"
The power I'd gathered in my staff shot out of it, an invisible serpent of energy. The shield fell just as a shrieking gale of wind shot down the stairs. The column of air howled against me, throwing my duster forward around me like a flag, and caught the blazing napalm like a tub of jello, hurling the fire back the way it had come, and providing it with air enough to treble its size. The fire went mad. It seared mortar from rough stone and chewed cracks into the rock floor, the damp stone coughing and popping as water within expanded. For an instant, I could see the two Renfields still spraying fire toward me. They started screaming, but they obeyed Mavra's raspy howls to stand fast, and it killed them. The napalm molded itself to them, and the flame embraced them. What hit the ground as they fell could not have been easily identified as human remains. I kept my will on the wind, the carved runes on my staff blazing ember orange, and it spread the flames into the far room in a deadly river of searing light and charred black ash. For agonized seconds, I held the winds and spread the flames, and then my will faltered, the runes on the staff dimming. Pain overcame me for a second, and it hurt so much that I literally could not see.
"Wizard!"
howled Mavra's voice, the words sounding like dusty scales and cold reptilian fury.
"Wizard! The wizard! Kill! Kill! Kill everything!"
"Get him!"
Kincaid snarled. I felt Murphy get her arms under mine, and she started hauling me back with surprising power. I started seeing through the blinding agony in time to see a charred, inhuman-looking man wielding an axe leap at Kincaid. The mercenary rammed his spear full into the man's chest, stopping him in his tracks. A second man appeared from the smoke behind the first, this one holding a shotgun. There was a roaring sound, and fire tore through the impaled Renfield, then struck the second one full in the face with hideous, searing results. Kincaid jerked the spear clean of the corpse of the first Renfield, even as the second flailed around wildly, then pointed the shotgun in more or less the right direction. Kincaid whirled the spear into a reverse grip, slammed it into the second Renfield's chest, and the second incendiary round blasted out from the housing at the butt end of the spear and drove the remaining life from the man. A burning corpse hit the floor a second later. A gun roared from the smoke. Kincaid grunted and staggered. The spear fell from his hands, but he didn't fall. He drew a gun in either hand and backed unsteadily away, the semi-automatic barking out shots as swiftly as he could send them into the choking smoke down the hall. More Renfields, roasted but functional, came through the smoke, shooting. Dark hounds bounded around them, the naked and bloody shells of dogs, but filled with horrible rage. Behind them I saw Mavra's slender, deadly form lit for the first time. She was wearing the same clothing I'd seen her in the last time, a tattered number from the Renaissance, all of black. Hamlet would have been happy to wear it. I saw her filmy, dead eyes focus on me, and she lifted an axe in one hand. The first two dark hounds reached Kincaid, and he went down under them before I could even cry out. One of the Renfields brought a sledgehammer down on him, while the other simply emptied a handgun into the pile as two more dark hounds threw themselves into it.
"No!"
I shouted. Murphy hauled me into the closet and out of the line of fire just as Mavra threw. Her axe came tumbling end over end down the hall and struck the stone wall at the back of the closet with such force that the head buried itself to the eye in the rock and the wooden handle shattered into splinters. Two of the children, still chained underneath where the axe hit, let out wails of pain and terror as splinters tore at them. "Oh, God," Murphy said. "Your hand, oh, God." But she never stopped moving. She shoved me by main force into the back corner of the closet, picked up her gun, leaned into the doorway, and sent 8 or 9 measured shots down the hall, her face set in grim concentration. Her pale legs were a startling contrast against the black of her Kevlar vest.
"Harry!" she shouted. "There's smoke! I can't see anything! But they're at the foot of the stairs! What do we do?"
I stared at a black box up on the wall, near the ceiling, presumably Kincaid's anti-personnel mine. He'd been right. It was set up to open and spew its deadly projectiles diagonally down so that they would bounce and fill both closet and hall with death.
"Harry!"
Murphy shouted. I barely had breath enough to answer.
"Can you hook up the mine again?"
She looked over her shoulder at me, eyes wide.
"You mean we can't get out?"
"Can you do it?" I barked. She nodded once.
"Wait for my signal, then arm it and get low."
She spun and leapt up onto a wooden chair near the mine, either something she had dragged there or something the bad guys had used too. She hooked up 2 alligator clips and held up a 3rd, looking over her shoulder at me, her face pale. The children wept and screamed below her. I dragged myself over to kneel in front of the children, facing down the hallway. I lifted my left hand and stared at it in shock for a second. I always thought I looked good in red and black, but as a rule, I preferred that to be my clothes, not my limbs. My hand was a blackened, twisted claw of badly cooked meat, burned dark wherever it wasn't blood red. My silver shield bracelet dangled beneath it, the charm shields heat-warped, gleaming and bright. I raised my other hand to signal Murphy, but then I heard a scream from down the hall, snarling and vicious and hardly human. The smoke swirled and cleared for a second, and I saw Kincaid dragging one leg, his back against the wall. He had one hand clenched hard to his leg and a gun in the other. He shot at a target I couldn't see until the gun started clicking.
"Now, Murphy!"
I shouted. My voice thundered down the hall.
"Kincaid! Bolshevik Muppet!"
The mercenary's head whipped around toward me. He moved like hamstrung lightning, swift and lurching and grotesque. He dropped the gun, released his leg, and threw himself straight at me with his 3 unwounded limbs. Again, I raised my shield and prayed that the mine's infrared tripwire functioned. Time slowed. Kincaid flung himself through the doorway. The mine beeped. There was a sharp, snapping click of metal. Kincaid tumbled past me. I leaned aside to let him, and at the same instant brought every scrap of strength I had left to bear on the shield. Lumpy metal spheres, maybe 20 or 30 of them, flew out into the air. I had angled my shield in a simple inclined plane, its base at the closet's doorway, its summit at the back wall of the closet, about 4 feet off the ground. Several of the spheres hit the shield, but the slope of it sent them rebounding out into the hall. The submunitions exploded in a ripple of thunder and light. Steel balls flew in deadly sprays, rattling off stone walls and tearing into flesh with savage efficiency. The sloped shield flared into azure incandescence, energy from the shrapnel being absorbed and shed as flashbulb bright bursts of light. The sound was indescribable, almost loud enough to kill all on its own. And then it was over. Silence fell, broken only by the crackling of flames. Nothing moved but drifting smoke. Murphy, Kincaid, the captive children, and I were all huddled together in an unorganized pile of frightened humanity. We all sat there stunned for a moment. Then I said,
"Come on, we have to get moving before the fire spreads."
My voice sounded raw.
"Let's get these kids out. I might be able to break these chains."
Kincaid reached up without speaking and took a key down from a high hook on the opposite wall. He settled back down to sit, leaning against it, and tossed me the key.
"Or we could do that," I said,
and passed the key to Murphy. She started unlocking them. I was too tired to move. My hand didn't hurt, which was a very bad sign, I knew. But I was too tired to care. I just sat there and stared at Kincaid. He had his hand clamped down on his leg again. He was bleeding from it. There was more blood on his belly, on one hand, and his face was positively smothered with it, as if he'd been bobbing for apples in a slaughterhouse. "You're hurt," I said.
"Yep," he replied.
"Dog. I saw you go down."
"It got nasty," he confirmed.
"What happened?" I asked.
"I lived."
"Your chest is bleeding," I said, "and there's blood on your hand."
"I know that.
And your face is drenched in it." He lifted an eyebrow and touched his free hand to his chin, then looked at the blood.
"Oh, that isn't mine."
He started fumbling at his belt. I got enough energy together to go to him and help. He pulled a roll of black duct tape from a pouch on his belt, and with sharp, jerking motions, we wound the tape tightly around his wounded leg several times, layering the wound in adhesive, literally taping it closed. He used about a third of the roll, then grunted and tore it off. Then he said,
"You're gonna lose that hand."
"I was sending it back to the kitchen anyway. I ordered it medium well."
Kincaid stared at me for a second, and then started letting out soft, wobbly-sounding laughter, as if it were something he didn't have a lot of practice at. He stood up, wheezing soft laughter, drew another gun and his own machete from his belt, and said,
"Get them out. I'm gonna dismember whatever's left."
"Groovy," I said.
"All that trouble we went to, and you just blew the place up. We could have done this to begin with, Dresden."
Murphy got the kids loose, and they started getting away from the wall. One of them, a girl no more than 5 years old, just collapsed against me, crying. I held on to her for a moment, letting her cry, and said, "No, we couldn't have." Kincaid regarded me, his expression unreadable. I thought I saw something wild and bloodthirsty and satisfied in his eyes for just a second. Then he said,
"Maybe you're right."
He vanished into the smoke. Murphy helped me to my feet. She had all the kids join hands, took the hand of the lead child herself, and led us all to the stairs. She bent and scooped up her jeans on the way. There wasn't enough denim left to avoid public indecency, and she dropped them with a sigh.
"Pink panties," I said, looking down.
"With little white bows. I wouldn't have guessed that." Murphy looked too tired to glare, but she tried.
"They really go with the Kevlar and the gun belt, Murph. Shows you're a woman with her priorities straight."
She stepped on my foot, smiling.
"Clear,"
said Kincaid's voice from the smoke. He appeared again, coughing a little.
"Found four coffins occupied. One of them was that one-ear guy you told me about. Beheaded them. Vampires are history."
"Mavra?" I asked. He shook his head.
"That whole end of the hall looks like a chop shop for a black market organ bank. The vampire took that blast from the mine right in the kisser. You'd need her dental records and a jigsaw puzzle all-star to get a positive ID."
Kincaid didn't see Mavra flicker into sight. She rose out of the smoke behind him, horribly torn and mangled, badly burned, and angry as hell. She was missing her lower jaw, half of an arm, a basketball-sized section of lower abdomen, and one of her legs was attached by only a scrap of flesh and her black tights. For all of that, she moved no less swiftly, and her eyes burned with dead fire. Kincaid saw the look on my face. He dropped flat. I whipped the stupid little paintball gun out of my duster and emptied it at Mavra. May lightning strike me dead if the damn thing didn't work like a charm. Hell, better than most charms, and I'm the guy who should know. The shots poured out almost as swiftly as from Kincaid's deadly little machine guns, and they splattered into Mavra, sizzling viciously. Silver fire immediately began chewing at her flesh wherever the paintballs struck and broke. It ripped into her, and it happened fast, as if some hyperkinetic gourmet were taking a melon baller to her flesh. Mavra let out a shocked and dusty shriek. The holy water and garlic paintballs put a hole as wide as a 3-liter bottle of Coke all the way through her. I could see the glow of fire in the pall of smoke behind her. She staggered and fell to her knees. Murphy drew the machete from her belt and threw it underhand. Kincaid caught it as he turned back to Mavra and took her head off at the base of her neck. The head went one way. The body went straight down. There was no thrashing, no howling or spurting ichor, no gales of magical wind or sudden clouds of dust. Mavra's remains simply thumped to the ground, nothing but a withered cadaver once more. I looked from Mavra's corpse to the paintball gun, impressed.
Kincaid? Can I keep this?
Sure, he said. I'll add it to the bill.
He stood up slowly, looking at the destruction. He shook his head. Then he joined us as we went up the stairs.
Even seeing it is tough to believe.
What is?
I asked.
Your shield. And that bit with all the wind and fire, especially with your hand like that.
He glanced at me, something like caution in his expression.
I've never seen a wizard cut loose before.
What the hell?
It wouldn't hurt to encourage the mercenary to be wary of me. I stopped and leaned on my staff. The runes still glowed with a sullen fire, though it was slowly fading. Tiny white wisps of wood smoke curled up from it, sharp in my nose. It hadn't ever done that before, but there was no reason to mention that for the time being. I looked straight at him until it was obvious that he was refusing to meet my eyes. Then I said in a quiet, gentle voice, "You still haven't." I walked on out, leaving him to stare after me. I didn't think for a second that he would allow what he'd seen to scare him out of killing me if I didn't pay him, but it might scare him enough to make him more cautious about taking that option. Every little bit helps. Before we got out of the shelter, I took off my duster and draped it onto Murphy's shoulders. It enveloped her entirely, its hem dragging the ground, covering her legs. She gave me a grateful look just as Ebenezer appeared in the doorway. The old man looked at the kids, then at my hand, and drew in a sharp breath.
"You all right to walk yourself out?" he asked.
"So far. We need to get these kids and ourselves the hell away from here."
"Fine," he said. "Where?"
"We'll take the kids to Father Forthill at St. Mary of the Angels," I said. "He'll have a good idea of what can be done to help them."
Ebenezer nodded. "I know him by reputation. Good man."
We went outside and started loading kids into Ebenezer's old Ford truck. The old man had a gun rack at the back of the cab, his thick old staff in the bottom rack, his old greener shotgun in the top one. He lifted the kids into the back one by one, where he had them lie down on a thick old thermal blanket and covered them with a second one. Kincaid came out of the shelter carrying a contractor's heavy garbage bag, the smoke growing thicker behind him. The bag was half full. He threw it over one shoulder, then turned to me and said,
"Taking care of details. As I see it, the contract is done. You satisfied with that?"
"Yeah," I said. "Nice working with you. Thank you."
Kincaid shook his head.
"The money is how you thank me."
Yeah, I said. "About that. It's Saturday, and I'm going to have to talk to someone at the bank."
He stepped closer to me and handed me a white business card. It had a number printed on it in gold lettering. There was another number written in ink that made the balance currently in my checking account look extremely small. Nothing else.
"My Swiss account," he explained. "And I'm in no hurry. Have it there by Tuesday, and we'll be square."
He got in the van and left. Tuesday. Crap. Ebenezer watched the white van pull out, then helped Murphy get me into the truck. I sat in the middle, my legs over on Murphy's side of the cab. She had a first aid kit in her hands, and as we rode along, she covered my burned hand lightly with gauze, entirely silent. Ebenezer drove off cautiously. We heard sirens start up when we were a couple of blocks away.
"The kids to the church," he said. "Then where?"
"My place," I said. "I'll get patched up for round two."
"Round two?" Ebenezer asked.
"Yeah," I said. "If I don't do something, a ritual entropy curse is going to head my way before midnight."
"How can I help?" he asked.
I looked steadily at him. "We'll have to talk about it."
He squinted out ahead of us and kept his emotions off of his face.
"Hoss, you're too involved. You do too much. You take on way too damn much."
"There's a bright side, though," I said.
"Oh?"
Uh-huh. If I buy it tonight, at least I won't have to figure out how to pay Kincaid before he kills me.
Chapter 34. Ebenezer drove, and I felt myself float off into a pensive haze. Well, that wasn't exactly true. It was more of a pence-less haze, but I didn't complain about it. My mouth didn't want to work, and on some level I knew that numb, floating shock was better than searing agony. Somewhere in the background, Murphy and Ebenezer talked enough to work out details, and we must have dropped the kids off with Father Fortil, because when I finally got out of the truck, the back was empty of children.
Murphy, I said, frowning, I had a thought. If there's an APB out for me, maybe we shouldn't go back to my place.
Harry, she said, we've been here for 2 hours. You're sitting on your couch. I looked around. She was right. The fireplace was going, with Mister in his favorite spot by the mantel, and the notch-eared puppy was lying on the couch next to me, using my leg as a pillow. I tasted scotch in my mouth, one of Ebenezer's own brews, but I didn't remember drinking it. Man, I must have been in worse shape than I thought.
So I am, I said, but that doesn't make my concerns any less valid.
Murphy had hung my coat up on its hook by the door and was wearing a pair of my knee-length knit shorts. They fell to halfway down her calf, and she'd had to tie a big knot in the front to keep them on, but at least she wasn't walking around in her panties. Damn it.
I don't think so, she said. I've talked to Stallings. He said there's an APB for someone matching your description, but your name isn't attached to it. Only that the suspect is wanted for questioning, and maybe using the alias Larry or Barry. There were no prints on the weapon, but it was registered to the witness.
She shook her head. I don't know how that happened. I'd say you got lucky, but I know better, and you'd make some wise-ass remark about it. I let out a broken little laugh.
Yeah, I said. Hell's bells. Trixie Vixen has got to be the most vacuous, conceited, small-minded, petty, and self-absorbed baddie I've ever snooped out. That's what happened.
What? Murphy asked.
My name, I said, still wheezing laughter. She never got it straight. The woman got my freaking name wrong. I don't think she bothers to keep very close track of other people's existence if it doesn't profit her.
Murphy arched an eyebrow.
But there were other people there, weren't there? Someone must have known your name.
I nodded. Arturo for sure, probably Joan, but everyone else only knew my first name.
And someone had to wipe any of your prints from the gun. They're covering for you, Murphy said.
I pursed my lips, surprised.
Not so much that Arturo and his people had done it, but because of my reaction to the news. It made a warm spot somewhere inside me that felt almost completely unfamiliar.
They are, I said. God knows why, but they are.
Harry, you saved the lives of some of their people. She shook her head. In the business they're in, I doubt Chicago's finest are exactly making them feel like valued members of the community. That kind of isolation brings people together, and you help them. Makes you one of them when trouble comes.
Makes me family, I said. She smiled a little and nodded.
So you know who done it?
Trixie, I said. Probably two others. My sense is that it's the ex-Mrs. Genosa Club, but that's just a hunch. And I think they had help.
Why do you say that?
Because Trixie was getting instructions from someone on the phone when she was holding a gun on me, I said. And they've been invoking that curse with a ritual. Unless someone's actually got some talent, it takes two or three people to raise the energy that's needed. And let's face it, three witches cackling over a cauldron somewhere is pretty much stereotyped into the public awareness.
Macbeth, Murphy said.
Yeah, and that movie with Jack Nicholson as the devil.
Can I ask you something?
Sure.
You told me about rituals once. The cosmic vending machine, right? An outside power offers to give you something if you fulfill a specific sequence of events.
Yeah.
Murphy shook her head.
Scary. People can just do a dance and someone dies? Regular people, I mean? What happens if someone publishes a book?
Someone has, I said. Plenty of times. The White Council has pushed it to happen a couple of times. Like with the Necronomicon. It's a reasonably good way to make certain the ritual in question isn't going to work. She frowned.
I don't get it. Why?
Supply and demand, I said.
There are limits to what outside forces can deliver to the mortal world. Think of the incoming power as water flowing through a pipeline. If a couple of people are using a rite once every couple of weeks or every few years, there's no problem pumping in enough magic to make it work. But if 50,000 people are trying to use the rite all at once, there isn't enough power in any one place to make it happen. It just comes out as a little dribble that tastes bad and smells funny. Murphy nodded, following me.
So people who have access to rituals don't want to share them?
Exactly.
And a book of dark rituals is not something your average vacuous princess of porn picks up at the mall. So she had help.
Yeah, I said, frowning. And that last run on the curse had a professional behind it.
Why do you say that?
It was a hell of a lot faster, for one thing, and deadlier. It hit so quick I didn't have time to redirect it away from the victim, even though I knew it was coming. It was stronger, too. A lot stronger. Like someone who knew the business had taken the trouble to focus or amplify it somehow.
What can do that? Murphy asked.
Coordination between talented wizards, I said. Sometimes you can use certain articles and materials to amplify magic. They're usually expensive as hell. Sometimes special locations can help, places like Stonehenge, or certain positions of stars on a given night of the year. Then there's the old standby.
What's that? Murphy asked.
Blood, I said. The destruction of life, the sacrifice of animals, or people. Murphy shivered.
And you think they're coming after you next?
Yeah, I said. I'm in the way. They have to if they want to get away clean.
Get away with their big old fund intact.
Yeah, I said.
Seems pretty extreme for a greed killing, Murphy said. I've got nothing against greed as a motivator, but damn. It's like some people just never grasp the idea that other people actually exist.
Yeah, I said with a sigh. I guess this time there just happened to be three of them standing in the same place.
Huh, Murphy said.
God only knows what kind of unholy bad luck got three ex-wives together. I mean, what are the odds, you know?
I sat up straight. Murphy had put her finger on it.
Stars and stones, you're right. How could I have missed that?
You've been a little busy, Murphy guessed. I felt my heart speed up. It beat with a dull pressure on my hand. It wasn't pain yet, but it was coming.
Okay, let's think here. Arturo didn't announce that he was getting married again. I mean, I only found out because someone who knows him made a sharp guess. And I doubt the ex-wives knew about it firsthand. In fact, I'd be willing to bet they were informed of the fact by a third party.
Why? Murphy asked.
Because if you want to work magic on someone, you've got to believe in it. You've got to want it. Otherwise it just fizzles. That means that they want someone dead. Genuinely want it.
Because when they found out, it was a nasty surprise, Murphy said.
Maybe whoever told them tilted things even further before the ex-wives found out. Made it hit them really hard. Make them really mad.
I don't know, Harry.
You need a fourth party to want Arturo's new squeeze nixed for that to hold water.
Yeah, I agreed.
Then I felt my eyes widen. Unless that wasn't what they wanted at all.
Murph, I don't think this is about money.
I don't understand.
Genosa's in love, I said. I felt myself rise to my feet.
Son of a bitch! It was right there in front of me the whole time.
Murphy frowned and rose with me, putting her hand on my good arm.
Harry, you need to sit back down, all right? You're hurt. You need to sit down until Ebenezer gets back.
What?
Ebenezer. He thinks he can do something for your hand, but he had to pick up something first.
Oh, I said. My head spun a little. She tugged at my arm and I sat back down.
But that's it.
What's it?
Trixie and the other Stregas are just weapons for someone else.
Genosa is in love. That's why he didn't react to Lara like everyone else. They can't touch him. That's what this is all about.
Murphy frowned.
What do you mean?
Who is using them as weapons?
The White Court, I said. Lord Wraith and the White Court. It's no coincidence that he and his second-in-command are in Chicago this weekend. What does Genosa's being in love have to do with anything? The White Court can control people. I mean, they seduce them, get close, and before long they can sink in the psychic hooks. They can make slaves of the people they feed on, and make them like it to boot. That's the source of their power. Murphy arched an eyebrow. But not if someone is in love? I laughed weakly. Yeah, they just said it out loud. It was an internal matter. Hell, it was practically the first thing she said about him, that Arturo was always falling in love. What who said? Joan, I said. Plain old, practical, flannel-wearing, donut-scarfing Joan. And Lara the Wonder Slut. Not in that order, I'm sure of it. Murphy scowled. Egad, Holmes, you've got to provide me with some context if you want me to understand. Okay, I said. Here's the setup, all right? Wraith is the leader of the White Court, but over the past several years, he's been losing face. His personal power base is slowly eroding. Why? Thomas, mainly, I said. Wraith apparently murders his sons before they start getting ideas of knocking him off and taking over the family business. He sent Thomas to get killed at the vampire masquerade ball, but Thomas hooked up with Michael and me and came out of it alive. Then Wraith set Thomas up again last year at the duel with Ortega, but Thomas got through that one, too. And from what I've deduced, Papa Wraith isn't putting the fear of himself into his own children very well anymore. What's that got to do with Genosa? She asked. Genosa publicly defied Wraith's authority, I said. Arturo told me that someone had been slowly buying up the adult movie companies, manipulating things from behind the scenes. Trace the money trail back, and I'd bet you dollars to donuts that you'll find that it's Wraith and that he owns Silverlight. By leaving Silverlight Studios and going off to break stereotypes by doing his own movies, Genosa was defying Wraith's authority in a very public way. So you're saying that the White Court controls the erotica industry? Or at least a bunch of it, I confirmed. Think about it. It can influence people's opinions of all kinds of things. What physical beauty is, what sex is, how one should react to temptation, what is acceptable behavior in intimate relationships. My God, Murph. It's like training deer to come to a particular feeding point to make stalking and killing them easier. Her mouth fell open for a moment. God, that's sort of terrifying. That's huge. And insidious, I said. I never even thought about something like that happening. Or maybe it's fairer to say that it's been happening. Maybe Wraith was just taking over the business from some other player in the White Court. So when Genosa thumbed his nose at Silverlight, it made Lord Wraith look even weaker. Yeah, I said. A mere human defying the White King. And Wraith couldn't send Lara to control him either, because Genosa is in love. Meaning? The White Court can't touch someone who is in love, I said. Real love. If they try to feed on them, it causes them physical agony. It's their holy water, I guess you could say. Their silver bullet. They're terrified of it. Murphy's eyes brightened, and she nodded. Wraith wasn't able to control Genosa, so he had to find a way to torpedo the guy instead, or lose face. And be torn from his position of power, exactly. Why not just kill Genosa? I shook my head. The White Court seems to pride itself on elegance when it comes to power games. Thomas told me that when the Whites go to war with one another, they do it through indirect means, cat's paws. The more untraceable, the better. They believe that intelligence and manipulation are more important than mere strength. If Wraith just popped a cap in Arturo, it would have been still another loss of face. So he finds someone he can control, Murphy said. He sets them up to find out that the new wife is a danger to their positions, and he does it in the worst possible way, to make them readier to take action. He even hands them the murder weapon, a big, nasty, dark ritual. He's not sure who it is, so he tells them to get rid of whoever Genosa is secretly engaged to. They've got a means, a motive, and an opportunity. Even in magical circles, I'll bet no one's going to be able to easily prove it was Wraith who was responsible for the death of the woman Arturo was engaged to. And in love with, I said. For Lord Wraith, it's a win-win situation. If they kill the fiancé, it will destabilize Genosa and hamper his ability to produce films. Hell, maybe Wraith wanted to wait until he fell into a depression afterward, and then send one of the ex-wives after a while to offer comfort, seduce him, and leave him vulnerable to Lara's control. If they don't manage to kill the fiancé, they might still create enough havoc and confusion to derail Genosa's work. And even if someone on the spooky end of the block figures out who done it, Wraith has it set up so that they can't be traced back to him. Yeah, I said. Meanwhile, Arturo is back in the fold, and Wraith has reconsolidated his power base. End of problem. But not if you interfere and stop him. Not if I interfere and stop him, I agreed. So, once Wraith gets word that I'm sticking my nose into his business, he brings in Lara to keep an eye on me and take me out if she can. Or just take you, Murphy said. If this guy is a schemer, maybe he thought it would be great to have this Lara get hooks into you. The puppy stirred, disturbed. I shivered and petted him. Ugh, I said. But it didn't work, and I'm close to blowing the whole thing wide open. Now he'll have to take a swing at me and get me out of the picture. Murphy made a growling sound. Gutless bastard, going through other people like that. It's smart, I said. If he really has been weakened, he wouldn't want to take on anyone from the White Council directly. Only a fool goes toe-to-toe with a stronger enemy. That's why Thomas did the same thing as his father, recruiting me to go up against him. Murphy whistled. You're right. How the hell did you get this bag of snakes? Clean living, I said. You should tell Thomas to get lost, Murphy said. Can't. Why not? I looked at her in silence. Her eyes widened. She understood. It's him. He's family. Half-brother, I said. Our mother used to hang around with Lord Wraith. She nodded. So what are you going to do? Survive. I mean about Thomas. I'll burn that bridge when I come to it. Fair enough, Murphy said. But what's your next move? Go to Thomas, I said. Make him help. I looked down at my bandaged hand. I need a car and a driver. Done, said Murphy. I frowned, thinking, and I might need something else from you tonight, something tough. What? I told her. She stared silently past me for a moment and then said, God, Harry. I know, I hate to ask it, but it's our only shot. I don't think we can win this one with simple firepower. She shivered. Okay. You sure? You don't have to do it. I'm with you, she said. Thank you, Karen. She gave me a small smile. At least this way I feel like I get to do something to help. Don't be silly, I said. The image of you gunfighting in your panties is going to boost my morale for years. She kicked my leg gently with hers, but her smile was somewhat wooden. She looked down to focus on the puppy, who promptly rolled over on his back, chewing at her fingers. You okay? I asked. You got kind of quiet. I'm fine, she said. Mostly. It's just... Just? She shook her head. It's been sort of a stressful day for me, relationship-wise. I know what you mean, I thought. I mean, first that asshole Rich and Lisa, and... She glanced at me, her cheeks pink. And this thing with Kincaid. You mean him taking your pants off? She rolled her eyes. Yeah, it's been... Well, it's been a really, really long time since a good-looking man took my pants off. I sort of forgot how much I enjoyed it. I mean, I know this is just a reaction to the danger and adrenaline and so on, but still, I've never reacted that strongly to a simple touch. Oh, I said. She sighed. Well, you asked. It's got me a little distracted, that's all. Just so you know, I said, I don't think he's human. I think he's pretty major bad news. Yeah, Murphy said, her voice annoyed. It's never the nice guys who get a girl worked up. Apparently not. Oh, I said again. I'll call a cab, Murphy said. Get some clothes and my bike. The car's still back at the park, and there might still be family there. Give me about an hour, and I'll be ready to take you where you need to go, if you're able.
I have to be, I said.
Murphy called the cab, and just as it got there, Ebenezer opened the door, carrying a brown paper grocery sack. I looked up at him, feeling a sudden blend of emotions. Relief, affection, suspicion, disappointment, betrayal. It was a mess. He saw the look. He stopped in the doorway and said,
Hoss, how's the hand?
Starting to feel things again, I said. But I figure I'll pass out before it comes all the way back.
Might be able to help a little, if you want me to.
Let's talk about that. Murphy had pretty obviously picked up on the tension between us back at the shelter. She kept her tone and expression neutral and said, My cab's here, Harry. See you in an hour. Thanks, Murph, I said.
Pleasure to meet you, Miss Murphy, Ebenezer said. He corrected himself almost instantly. Lieutenant Murphy.
She almost smiled. Then she gave me a look, as if to ask me if it was all right to leave me with the old man. I nodded, and she left. Close the door, I told Ebenezer. He did, and turned to face me.
So? What do you want me to tell you?
The truth, I said. I want the truth.
No, you don't, Ebenezer said. Or at least not now. Harry, you have to trust me on this one.
No, I don't, I responded. My voice sounded rough and raw. I've trusted you for years. Completely. I've built up some credit. You owe me. Ebenezer looked away. I want answers. I want the truth.
It will hurt, he said.
The truth does that sometimes. I don't care.
I do, he said. Boy, there is no one. No one I would hate to hurt as much as you. And this is too much to lay on your shoulders, especially right now. It could get you killed, Harry.
That isn't your decision to make, I said quietly. It surprised me how calm I sounded. I want the truth. Give it to me. Or get out of my home and never come back. Frustration, even true anger, flickered across the old man's face. He took a deep breath, then nodded. He put the grocery sack down on my coffee table and folded his arms, facing my fireplace. The lines on his face looked deeper. His eyes focused into the fire, or through it, and they were hard, somehow frightening.
All right, he said. Ask. I'll answer. But this could change things for you, Harry. It could change the way you think and feel.
About what?
About yourself, about me, about the White Council, about everything.
I can take it. Ebenezer nodded.
All right, Hoss. Don't say I didn't warn you.
Chapter 35.
Let's start simple, I said.
How do you know Kincaid? He blew out a breath, cheeks puffing out.
He's in the trade.
The trade?
Yes.
Ebenezer sat down on the other end of the couch. The puppy got up on wobbling legs and snuffled over to examine him. His tail started wagging. Ebenezer gave the little dog a brief smile and scratched his ears.
Most of the mage's supernatural powers have someone for that kind of work. Ortega was the Red Courts, for example. Kincaid and I are contemporaries, of a sort.
You're assassins, I said. He didn't deny it.
Didn't look like you liked him much, I said. There are proprieties between us, Ebenezer said. A measure of professional courtesy and respect. Boundaries. Kincaid crossed them about a century ago in Istanbul.
He's not human? Ebenezer shook his head. Then what is he?
There are people walking around who carry the blood of the Never Never in them. Ebenezer said. Changelings, for one, those who are half-she. The fairies aren't the only ones who can breed with humanity, though, and the scions of such unions can have a lot of power. Their offspring are usually malformed, freakish, often insane, but sometimes the child looks human.
Like Kincaid. Ebenezer nodded.
He's older than I am. When I met him, I still had hair, and he had been serving the creature for centuries.
What creature? I asked.
The creature, Ebenezer said. Another half-mortal like Kincaid. Vlad Dracul. I blinked.
Vlad Tepesh? Dracula?
Ebenezer shook his head. Dracula was the son of Dracul, and pretty pale and skinny by comparison. Went to the Black Court as a kind of teenage rebellion. The original creature is, well, formidable, dangerous, cruel. And Kincaid was his right arm for centuries. He was known as the Hound of Hell, or just the Hellhound. And he's afraid of you, I said, my voice bitter. Blackstaff McCoy. I guess that's your working name?
Something like that. The name is a long story.
Get started, then, I said. He nodded, absently rubbing the puppy behind the ears.
Ever since the founding of the White Council, ever since the first wizards gathered to lay down the laws of magic, there has been someone interested in tearing it apart, he said. The vampires, for one. The fairies have all been at odds with us at one time or another, and there have always been wizards who thought the world would be a nicer place without the council in it.
Gee, I said, I just can't figure out why any wizard would think that. Ebenezer's voice lashed out, harsh and cold.
You don't know what you're talking about, boy. You don't know what you're saying. Within my own lifetime, there have been times and places where even speaking those words could have been worth your life.
Gosh, I'd hate for my life to be in jeopardy. Why did he call you Blackstaff? I asked, my voice hardening. An intuition hit me. It's not a nickname, I said. Is it? It's a title.
A title, he said. A solution.
At times the White Council found itself bound by its own laws, while its enemies had no such constraints. So, an office was created. A position within the council. A mark of status. One wizard, and only one, was given the freedom to choose when the laws had been perverted and turned as weapons against us. I stared at him for a moment and then said,
after all that you taught me about magic, that it came from life, that it was a force that came from the deepest desires of the heart, that we have a responsibility to use it wisely, hell, to be wise and kind and honorable, to make sure that the power gets used wisely. You taught me all of that. And now you're telling me that it doesn't mean anything. That the whole time you were standing there with a license to kill.
The lines in the old man's face looked hard and bitter. He nodded. To kill. To enthrall. To invade the thoughts of another mortal. To seek knowledge and power from beyond the outer gates. To transform others. To reach beyond the borders of life, to swim against the currents of time.
You're the White Council's wet works man, I said. For all their prattle about the just and wise use of magic, when the wisdom and justice of the laws of magic get inconvenient, they have an assassin. You do that for them.
He said nothing. You kill people.
Yes.
Ebenezer's face looked like something carved in stone, and his voice was quietly harsh.
When there is no choice. When lives are at stake. When the lack of action would mean...
He cut himself off, jaw working.
I didn't want it. I still don't. But when I have to, I act.
Like at Casa Verde, I said. You hit Ortega's stronghold when he escaped our duel.
Yes, he said, still remote. Ortega killed more of the White Council than any enemy in our history during the attack at Archangel.
His voice faltered for a moment.
He killed Simon, my friend. Then he came here and tried to kill you, Hoss. And he was coming back here to finish the job as soon as he recovered. So I hit Casa Verde, killed him. and almost 200 of his personal retainers. And I killed nearly 100 people there in the house with them. Servants, followers, food. I felt sick. You told me it would be on the news. I thought maybe it was the council, or that you'd done it without killing anyone but vampires. I had time to think about it later, but I wanted to believe you'd done what was right.
There's what's right, the old man said, and then there's what's necessary. They ain't always the same.
Casa Verde wasn't the only necessary thing you did, I said. Was it?
Casa Verde, Ebenezer said, his voice shaking. Tunguska, New Madrid, Krakatoa. A dozen more. God help me, a dozen more at least.
I stared at him for a long moment. Then I said, you told me the council assigned me to live with you because they wanted to annoy you. But that wasn't it. Because you don't send a potentially dangerous criminal element to live with your hatchet man if you want to rehabilitate him. He nodded.
My orders were to observe you and kill you if you showed the least bit of rebelliousness.
Kill me, I rubbed at my eyes. The pounding in my hand grew worse. As I remember, I got rebellious with you more than once.
You did, he said.
Then why didn't you kill me?
Jehoshaphat, boy. What's the point of having a license to ignore the will of the council if you aren't going to use it?
He shook his head, a tired smile briefly appearing on his mouth.
It wasn't your fault you got raised by that son of a bitch, Demone. You were a dumb kid, you were angry and afraid, and your magic was strong as hell. But that didn't mean you needed killing. They gave the judgment to me, I used it. They aren't happy with how I used it, but I did.
I stared at him. There's something else you aren't telling me. He was silent for a minute, then two, and a while later he said,
the council knew that you were the son of Margaret Le Fay. They knew that she was one of the wizards who had turned the council's own laws against it. She was guilty of violating the first law, among others, and she had unsavory associations with various entities of dubious reputation. The wardens were under orders to arrest her on sight. She'd have been tried and executed in moments when she was brought before the council.
I was told she died in childbirth, I said.
She did, Ebenezer confirmed. I don't know why, but for some reason she turned away from her previous associates, including Justin Demone. After that, nowhere was safe for her. She ran from her former allies and from the wardens for perhaps 2 years, and she ran from me. I had my orders regarding her as well.
I stared at him in pained fascination. What happened?
She met your father. A man. A mortal, without powers, without influence, without resources. But a man with a good soul, like few I have ever seen. I believe that she fell in love with him. But on the night you were born, one of her former allies found her and exacted his vengeance for her desertion.
He looked up at me directly and said,
he used an entropy curse, a ritual entropy curse.
Shock paralyzed me for a moment. Then I said, Lord Wraith.
Yes.
He killed my mother.
He did,
Ebenezer confirmed.
God.
You're sure?
He's a snake, Ebenezer said. But I'm as sure as I can be.
The pounding spread up my arm, and the room pulsed brighter and dimmer in time with it. My mother. He was standing 3 feet from me. He killed my mother. A child's pain. The emptiness in my life, the shape of my unknown mother, my unfortunate father, swelled and screamed in rage. The source of that pain, or part of it, had finally been revealed to me. And in that moment, had I known where to strike, I would have eagerly embraced murder.
Nothing mattered but exacting retribution. Nothing mattered but taking righteous vengeance for the death of a child's mother. My mother. I started shaking, and I knew that my sanity was buckling under the pressure.
Hoss? Ebenezer said.
Easy, boy.
Kill him,
I whispered.
I'll kill him.
No,
Ebenezer said.
You've got to breathe, boy. Think.
I started gathering power.
Kill him. Kill him. Everything. All of it. Nothing left.
Harry,
Ebenezer snapped.
Harry, let go. You can't handle that kind of power. You'll kill yourself if you try.
I didn't care about that either. The power felt too good, too strong. I wanted it. I wanted Wraith to pay. I wanted him to suffer, screaming, and then die for what he had done to me. And I was strong enough to make it happen. I had the power and the resolve to bring such a tide of magic against him that he would be utterly destroyed. I would lay him low and make him howl for mercy before I tore him apart. He deserved nothing less. And then fire blossomed in my hand again, so sudden and sharp that my back convulsed into an agonized arch and I fell to the floor. I couldn't scream. The pain washed my fury away like dandelions before a flash flood. I looked around wildly and saw the old man's broad, calloused hand clamped down over my burned, lightly bandaged flesh with bruising strength. When he saw my eyes, he released my hand. His expression sickened. I curled up for a minute while my pounding heart telegraphed consecutive tidal waves of agony through me. It was several minutes before I could master the pain and sit slowly up again.
I'm sorry, Ebenezer whispered. Harry, I can't let you indulge your rage. You'll kill yourself.
I'll take him with me, I got out between gritted teeth. Ebenezer let out a bitter laugh.
No, you won't, Hoss.
How do you know?
I've tried, he said, 3 times. And I didn't even get close. And you think your mother went without spending her death curse on her murderer? The creature who had enslaved her? Might as well ask if a fish remembered to swim.
I blinked at him.
What do you mean?
He's protected, he said quietly. Magic just slides off him.
Even a death curse?
Useless, he said bitterly. Wraith is protected by something big. Maybe a big damn demon. Maybe even some old god. He can't be touched with magic.
Is that even possible? I asked.
Aye, the old man said. I don't know how, but it is. Does a lot to explain how he got to become the White King.
I don't believe it, I said quietly. She'd been close to him. She must have known he was protected. She was strong enough to make the White Council afraid of her. She wouldn't have spent her curse for nothing. She threw it. She wasted it.
So now my mother is incompetent as well as evil, I said.
I never said that.
What do you know about her? I said.
I had my right hand clamped around my left wrist, hoping to distract myself from the pain.
How would you know? Did she tell you? Were you there with her?
He looked down at the floor, his face pale.
No.
Then how the hell do you know?
I demanded. His words came out in a harsh croak.
Because I knew her, Hoss. I knew her almost better than she knew herself.
The fire crackled.
How?
I whispered. He drew his hand back from the puppy.
She was my apprentice. I was her teacher, her mentor. She was my responsibility.
You taught her?
I failed her.
He chewed on his lip.
Harry, when Maggie was coming into her power, I made her life a living hell. She was barely more than a child, but I rode herd on her night and day. I pushed her to learn, to excel, but I was too close, too involved, and she resented it. She ran off as soon as she could get away with it, started taking up with bad sorts out of sheer rebellion. She made a couple of bad decisions,
And then it was too late for her to go back. He sighed. You're so much like her. I knew it when they sent you to me. I knew it the minute I saw you. I didn't want to repeat my mistakes with you. I wanted you to have breathing space, to make up your own mind about what kind of person you would be. He shook his head. The hardest lesson a wizard has to learn is that even with so much power, there are some things you can't control, no matter how much you want to. I just stared at him. You're an assassin, a murderer. You knew about what happened to my mother. You knew her, and you never told me. Good God, Ebenezer, how could you do that to me? Why didn't you tell me? I'm only human, Hoss. I did what I thought was best for you at the time. I trusted you, I said. Do you know how much that means to me? Yes, he said. I never did it with the intention of hurting you. But it's done. And I wouldn't choose to do it any differently if it happened again. He moved, got the sack, and hunkered down by me so that he could rest my forearm over one knee and examine the burned hand. Then he reached into the bag and drew out a long strand of string hung with some kind of white stone. Let's see to your hand. I think I can get the circulation restored, at least a little. Maybe enough to save the hand. And I can stop the pain for a day or two. You'll still have to get to a doctor, but this should tide you over if you're expecting trouble tonight. It didn't take him long, and I tried to sort through my thoughts. They were buried under a storm of raw emotions, all of them ugly. I lost track of time again for a minute. When I looked up, my hand didn't hurt, and it seemed a little less withered beneath the white bandages. A string of white stones had been tied around my wrist. Even as I watched, one of them yellowed and began to slowly darken. The stones will absorb the pain for a while. They'll crumble one at a time, so you'll know when they stop working. He looked up to my face. Do you want my help tonight? An hour ago, it wouldn't even have been a question. I'd have been more than glad to have Ebenezer next to me in a fight. But the old man had been right. The truth hurt. The truth burned. My thoughts and feelings boiled in a blistering, dangerous tumult in my chest. I didn't want to admit what was at the core of that turmoil, but denying it wouldn't make it any less true. Ebenezer had lied to me from day one. And if he'd been lying to me, what else had he lied about? I'd built my whole stupid life on a few simple beliefs. That I had a responsibility to use my power to help people. That it was worth risking my own life and safety to defend others. Beliefs I had taken as my own primarily because of the old man's influence. But he hadn't been what I thought he was. Ebenezer wasn't a paragon of wizardly virtue. If anything, he was a precautionary tale. He had seemed to talk a good game, but underneath that surface, he'd been as cold and as vicious as any of the cowardly bastards in the council, whom I despised. Maybe he'd never claimed to be a shining example. Maybe I just needed someone to admire, to believe in. Maybe I'd been the stupid one, putting my faith in the wrong place. But none of that changed the fact that Ebenezer had hidden things from me, that he'd lied. That made it simple. No, I whispered. I don't want you there. I don't know you. I never did. But you'd fight beside someone like the Hellhound. Kincaid's a killer for hire. He never pretended he was anything else. The old man exhaled slowly and said, I reckon that ain't unfair. Thank you for your help, but I've got things to do. You should go. He rose, picked up the paper bag, and said, I'm still there for you, Hoss. If you change you, I felt my teeth clench. I said, get out. He blinked his eyes a few times and whispered, a hard lesson. The hardest. Then he left.
I refused to watch him go.
Chapter 36. I sat in the silence of the old man's departure and felt a lot of things. I felt tired, I felt afraid, and I felt alone. The puppy sat up and displayed some of the wisdom and compassion of his kind. He wobbled carefully over to me, scrambled up onto my lap, and started licking the bottom of my chin. I petted his soft baby fur, and it gave me an unexpected sense of comfort. Sure, he was tiny, and sure, he was just a dog, but he was warm and loving and a brave little beast, and he liked me. He kept on giving me puppy kisses, tail wagging, until I finally smiled at him and roughed up his fur with one hand. Mister wasn't about to let a mere dog outdo him. The hefty Tom promptly descended from his perch on my bookshelf and started rubbing himself back and forth under my hand until I paid attention to him, too.
I guess you aren't nothing but trouble, I told the dog. But I already have a furry companion, right, mister?
Mister blinked at me with an enigmatic cat expression, batted the puppy off the couch and onto the floor, and promptly lost interest in me. Mister flowed back down onto the floor, where the puppy rolled to his feet, tail wagging ferociously, and began to romp clumsily around the cat, thrilled with the game. Mister flicked his ears with disdain, and went back up onto his bookshelf. I laughed. I couldn't help it. The world might be vicious and treacherous and deadly, but it couldn't kill laughter. Laughter, like love, has power to survive the worst things life has to offer, and to do it with style. It got me moving. I dressed for trouble, black fatigue pants, a heavy wool shirt of deep red, black combat boots. I put on my gun belt with one hand, clipped my sword cane to the belt, and covered it with my duster. I made sure I had my mother's amulet and my shield bracelet, sat down, and called Thomas's cell phone. The phone got about half of a ring out before someone picked it up, and a girl's frightened voice asked, "Tommy?" "Inari?" I asked. "Is that you?" "It's me," she confirmed. "This is Harry, isn't it?"
"For another few hours, anyway," I said. "May I speak to Thomas, please?"
"No," Inari said. It sounded like she had been crying. "I was hoping this was him. I think he's in trouble." I frowned. "What kind of trouble?"
"I saw one of my father's men," she said. "I think he had a gun. He made Thomas drop his phone in the parking lot and get into the car. I didn't know what I should do."
"Easy, easy," I said. "Where was he taken from?"
"The studio," she said, her voice miserable. "He gave me a ride here when we heard about the shooting. I'm here now."
"Is Lara there?" I asked.
"Yes, she's right here."
"Put her on, please."
"Okay,"
Inari said. The phone rustled. A moment later, Lara's voice glided out of the phone and into my ear.
"Hello, Harry."
"Lara, I know your father is behind the curse on Arturo, along with Arturo's wives. I know they've been gunning for his fiancée so that Wraith can get Arturo back under his control, and I have a question for you."
"Oh?" she said.
"Yeah. Where is Thomas?"
"It excites me when a man is so subtle," she said, "so debonair."
"Better brace yourself, then," I said. "I want him in one piece. I'm willing to kill anyone who gets in the way, and I'm willing to pay you to help me."
"Really?" Lara said. I heard her murmur something, presumably to Inari. She waited a moment. I heard a door close, and the tone of her voice changed subtly, becoming businesslike.
"I am willing to hear you out."
"And I'm willing to give you House Wraith, and the White Court with it."
Shocked silence followed. Then she said,
"And how would you manage such a thing?"
"I remove your father from power. You take over."
"How vague. The situation isn't a simple one," she said, but I could hear a throbbing note of excitement in her voice. "The other houses of the White Court follow House Wraith because they fear and respect my father. It seems unlikely that they would transfer that respect to me."
"Unlikely, not impossible. I think it can be done."
She made a slow, low, purring sound.
"Do you? And what would you expect from me in return? If my father has decided to remove Thomas, I am hardly capable of stopping him.
You won't need to. Just take me to him. I'll get Thomas myself.
After which my father will be so impressed with your diplomatic skills that he cedes the house to me?
Something like that, I said. Get me there. Then all you have to do is watch from the sidelines while Cat's Paw Dresden handles your father.
Hmm, she said. That would certainly raise my status among the lords of the court. To arrange for a usurpation isn't so unusual, but very few manage to have good seats to it as well. A first-hand view of it would be a grace note few have attained.
Plus, if you were standing right there and things went badly for me, you'd be in a good spot to backstab me and keep your father's goodwill.
Of course, she said, without a trace of shame. You understand me rather well, wizard.
Oh, there's one other thing I want.
Yes, she asked.
Leave the kid alone. Don't push her. Don't pressure her. You come clean with Inari. You tell her the deal with her bloodline, and you let her make up her own mind when it comes to her future.
She waited for a beat, and then said, That's all?
That's all.
She purred again. My, I am not yet sure if you are truly that formidable, or simply a vast and mighty fool. But for the time being, I am finding you an extremely exciting man.
All the girls tell me that.
She laughed. Let us assume for a moment that I find your proposal agreeable. I would need to know how you intend to overthrow my father. He's somewhat invincible, you see.
No, he isn't, I said. I'm going to show you how weak he really is.
And how do you know this?
I closed my eyes and said, Insight. Lara lapsed into a thoughtful silence for a moment. Then she said,
There is something else I must know, wizard. Why? Why do this?
I owe Thomas for favors past, I said. He's been an ally, and if I leave him hanging out to dry, it's going to be bad for me in the long term, when I need other allies. If the plan comes off, I also get someone in charge of things at the White Court who is more reasonable to work with.
Lara made a soft sound that was probably mostly pensive, but that would have been a lot more interesting in the dark.
In person.
No, she said then. That's not all of it.
Why not?
That would be sufficient reason if it were me, she said. But you aren't like me, wizard. You aren't like most of your own kind. I have no doubt that you have reasonable skill at the calculus of power, but calculation is not at the heart of your nature. You prepare to take a terrible risk, and I would know why your heart is set to it.
I chewed on my lip for a second, weighing my options and the possible consequences. Then I said, Do you know who Thomas's mother was?
Margaret Le Fay, she said, puzzled. But what does that...
She stopped abruptly.
Ah, now I see. That explains a great deal about his involvement in political matters over the past few years. She let out a little laugh, but it was somehow sad. You're much like him, you know. Thomas would sooner tear off his own arm than see one of his siblings hurt. He's quite irrational about it.
Is that reason enough for you? I asked.
I am not yet entirely devoid of affection for my family, wizard. It satisfies me.
Besides, I added, I've just handed you a secret with the potential for some fairly good blackmail down the line.
She laughed. Oh, you do understand me.
Are you in?
There was silence.
When Lara finally spoke again, her voice was firmer, more eager.
I do not know precisely where my father would have had Thomas taken.
Can you find out?
Her voice took on a pensive tone. In fact, I believe I can. Perhaps it was fate.
What was fate?
You'll see, she said. What sort of time frame did you have in mind?
An immediate one, I said. The immediater, the better.
I'll need half an hour, or a little more. Meet me at my family's home, north of town.
Half an hour-ish, I said. Until then. I hung up the phone just as a loud, low rumble approached my house. A moment later, Murphy came back in,
She was decked out in biker-grade denim and leather again.
I guess we're going somewhere.
Rev up the hog, I said. You ready for another fight?
Her teeth flashed. She tossed me a red motorcycle helmet and said,
Get on the bike, bitch.